Chapter 70. Is the first comer's plain duty to put the fire out in any way he can, drown it with water, blow it up with dynamite, use any and all means to stop the spread of the fire, and save the rest of the city? What is the Tsar of Russia but a house afire in the midst of a city of 80 millions of inhabitants? Yet instead of extinguishing him, together with his nest and system, the liberation parties are all anxious to merely cool him down a little and keep him. It seems to me that this is illogical, idiotic, in fact. Suppose you had this granite-hearted, bloody-jawed maniac of Russia loose in your house, chasing the helpless women and little children your own. What would you do with him, supposing you had a shotgun? Well, he is loose in your house, Russia. And with your shotgun in your hand, you stand trying to think up ways to oddify him. Do these liberation parties think that they can succeed in a project which has been attempted a million times in the history of the world, and has never in one single instance been successful, the oddification of a despotism by other means than bloodshed? They seem to think they can. My privilege to write these sanguinary sentences in soft security was bought for me by rivers of blood poured upon many fields, in many lands, but I possess not one single little paltry writer privilege that come to me as a result of petition, persuasion, agitation for reform, or any kindred method of procedure. When we consider that not even the most responsible English monarch ever yielded back a stolen public right until it was wrenched from them by bloody violence, is it rational to suppose that gentler methods can win privileges in Russia? Of course, I know that the properest way to demolish the Russian throne would be by revolution. But it is not possible to get up a revolution there, so the only thing left to do, apparently, is to keep the throne vacant by dynamite until a day when candidates shall decline with thanks. Then organize the republic. And on the whole, this method has some large advantages. For whereas a revolution destroys some lives which cannot well be spared, the dynamite way doesn't. Consider this. The conspirators against the Tsar's life are caught in every rank of life, from the low to the high. And consider. If so many take an active part, where the peril is so dire, is this not evidence that the sympathizers who keep still, and do not show their hands, are countless for multitudes? Can you break the hearts of thousands of families with the awful Siberian exodus every year for generations, and not eventually cover all Russia from limit to limit with bereaved fathers and mothers, and brothers and sisters who secretly hate the perpetrator of this prodigious crime and hunger and thirst for his life? Do you not believe that, if your wife or your child, or your father was exiled to the mines of Siberia for some trivial utterances wrung from a smarting spirit by the Tsar's intolerable tyranny, and you got a chance to kill him, and did not do it, that you would always be ashamed to be in your own society the rest of your life? Suppose that that refined and lovely Russian lady who was lately stripped bare before a brutal soldiery, and whipped to death by the Tsar's hand in the person of the Tsar's creature, had been your wife, or your daughter, or your sister, and today the Tsar should pass within reach of your hand, how would you feel and what would you do? Consider that all over vast Russia, from boundary to boundary, a myriad of eyes filled with tears when that piteous news came, and through those tears that myriad of eyes saw, not that poor lady, but lost darlings of their own whose fate or fate brought back with new access of grief out of a black and bitter past never to be forgotten or forgiven. If I am a Swinburnian and clear to the marrow I hold human nature in sufficient honor to believe there are 80 million mute Russians that are of the same stripe, and only one Russian family that isn't. Mark Twain. Typesetter matters were going badly. Clemens still had faith in Jones, and he had lost no grain of faith in the machine. The money situation, however, was troublesome. With an expensive establishment, and work of one sort or another still to be done on the machine, his income would not reach. Perhaps Goodman had already given up hope, for he does not seem to have returned from California after the next letter was written, a colorless letter in which we feel a note of resignation. The last few lines are sufficient. To Joe T. Goodman, in California. Dear Joe, I wish you could get a day off, and make those two or three Californians buy those privileges, for I'm going to need money before long. I don't know where the senator is, but out on the coast I reckon. I guess we've got a perfect machine at last. We never break a type now, and the new device for enabling the operator to touch the last letters and justify the line simultaneously works, to a charm. With love to you both, Mark. The year closed gloomily enough. The typesetter seemed to be perfected, but capital for its manufacture was not forthcoming. The publishing business of Charles 50, Webster and Company was returning little or no profit. Clemens' mother had died in Keokuk at the end of October, and his wife's mother, in Elmira a month later. Mark Twain, writing a short business letter to his publishing manager, Fred J. Ball, closed it: Merry Christmas to you. And I wish to God I could have one myself before I die. XXXI Letters, 1891, to Howells, Mrs. Clemens and others. Return to literature. American claimant. Leaving Hartford. Europe. Down the Rhine, Clemens was still, not without hope in the machine, at the beginning of the new year 1891, but it was a hope no longer active, and it presently became a moribund. Jones, on about the middle of February, backed out altogether, laying the blame chiefly on McKay and the others, who, he said, had decided not to invest. Jones had his victim down easy with friendly words, but it was the end, for the present, at least, of machine financiering. It was also the end of Mark Twain's capital. His publishing business was not good. It was already in debt and needing more money. There was just one thing for him to do, and he did it at once, not stopping to cry over spilt milk, but with good courage and the old enthusiasm that never failed him, he returned to the trade of authorship. He dug out half-finished articles and stories, finished them and sold them, and within a week after the Jones collapse he was at work on a novel, based on the old Sellers idea, which 8 years before he and Howells had worked into a play. The brief letter in which he reported this news to Howells bears no marks of depression, though the writer of it was in his 56th year. He was by no means well, and his financial prospects were anything but golden. To W.D. Howells, in Boston. Hartford, February 24, 91. Dear Howells, Mrs. Clemens has been sick abed for near 2 weeks, but is up and around the room now, and gaining. I don't know whether as he has written Mrs. Howells or not. I only know she was going to and will yet, if as he hasn't. We are promising ourselves a whole world of pleasure in the visit, and you mustn't dream of disappointing us. Does this item stir an interest in you? Began a novel 4 days ago, and this moment finished chapter 4. Title of the book, Olenal Mulberry Sellers. American claimant of the great earldom of Rossmore in the peerage of Great Britain. Is ever Mark. Probably Mark Twain did not return to literary work reluctantly. He had always enjoyed writing, and felt now that he was equipped better than ever for authorship, at least so far as material was concerned. There exists a fragmentary copy of a letter to some unknown correspondent, in which he recites his qualifications. It bears evidence of having been written just at this time, and is of unusual interest at this point. Fragment of letter to -1891. I confine myself to life with which I am familiar, when pretending to portray life. But I confined myself to the boy life out on the Mississippi, because that had a peculiar charm for me, and not because I was not familiar with other phases of life. I was a soldier 2 weeks once in the beginning of the war, and was hunted like a rat the whole time. Familiar? My splendid Kipling himself hasn't a more burnt-in, hard-baked, and unforgettable familiarity with that death on the pale horse with hell following after, which is a raw soldier's first fortnight in the field and which, without any doubt, is the most tremendous fortnight and the vividest he is ever going to see. Yes, and I have shoveled silver tailings in a quartz mill a couple of weeks, and acquired the last possibilities of culture in that direction. And I've done ocket mining during 3 months, in the one little patch of ground in the whole globe, where nature conceals gold in pockets or did before we robbed all of those pockets and exhausted, obliterated, annihilated the most curious freak nature ever indulged in. There are not 30 men left alive who, being told there was a pocket hidden on the broad slope of a mountain, would know how to go and find it, or have even the faintest idea of how to set about it. But I am one of the possible 20 or 30 who possess the secret, and I could go and put my hand on that hidden treasure with a most deadly precision. And I've been a prospector, and no pay rock from poor, when I find it just with a touch of the tongue. And I've been a silver miner, and know how to dig, and shovel and drill and put in a blast. And so I know the mines, and the miners interiorly as well as Bret Hart knows them exteriorly. And I was a newspaper reporter 4 years in cities, and so saw the inside of many things. And was reporter in a legislature 2 sessions, and the same in Congress 1 session, and thus learned to know personally 3 sample bodies of the smallest minds, and the selfishest souls and the cowardliest hearts that God makes. And I was some years a Mississippi pilot, and familiarly knew all the different kinds of steamboatmen a race apart, and not like other folk. And I was for some years a traveling car printer, and wandered from city to city, and so I know that sect familiarly. And I was a lecturer on the public platform a number of seasons, and was a responder to toasts at all the different kinds of banquets, and so I know a great many secrets about audiences, secrets, not to be got out of books, but only acquirable by experience. And I watched over one dear project of mine 4 years, spent a fortune on it, and failed to make it go, and the history of that would make a large book in which a million men would see themselves as in a mirror, and they would testify and say, "Verily, this is not imagination. This fellow has been there," and after would cast dust upon their heads, cursing and blaspheming. And I am a publisher, and did pay to one author's widow, General Grant's, the largest copyright checks this world has seen, aggregating more than $80,000 in the first year. And I have been an author for 20 years, and an ass for 55. Now then, as the most valuable capital or culture or education usable in the building of novels is personal experience, I ought to be well equipped for that trade. I surely have the equipment, a wide culture, and all of it real, none of it artificial, for I don't know anything about books. No signature. Clemens for several years had been bothered by rheumatism in his shoulder. The return now to the steady use of the pen aggravated his trouble, and at times he was nearly disabled. The phonograph for commercial dictation had been tried experimentally, and Mark Twain was always ready for any innovation. To W.D. Howells, in Boston. Hartford, February 28, 91. Dear Howells, won't you drop in at the Boylston Building, New England Phonograph Company, and talk into a phonograph in an ordinary conversation-voice? And see if another person who didn't hear you do it can take the words from the thing without difficulty and repeat them to you. If the experiment is satisfactory, also make somebody put in a message which you don't hear and see if afterward you can get it out without difficulty. Won't you then ask them on what terms they will rent me a phonograph for 3 months and furnish me cylinders enough to carry 75,000 words? 175 cylinders, ain't it? I don't want to erase any of them. My right arm is nearly disabled by rheumatism, but I am bound to write this book and sell 100. 000 copies of it. No, I mean a million next fall. I feel sure I can dictate the book into a phonograph if I don't have to yell. I write 2000 words a day. I think I can dictate twice as many. But mind, if this is going to be too much trouble to you, go ahead and do it, all the same. Is ever Mark. Howells, always willing to help, visited the phonograph place, and a few days later reported results. He wrote : I talked your letter into a phonograph in my usual tone at my usual gait of speech. Then the phonograph man talked his answer in at his wonted swing and swell. Then we took the cylinder to a typewriter in the next room, and she put the hooks into her ears, and wrote the whole out. I send you the result. There is a mistake of one word. I think that, if you have the cheek, to dictate the story into the phonograph, all the rest is perfectly easy. It wouldn't fatigue me to talk for an hour as I did. Clemens did not find the phonograph entirely satisfactory, at least not for a time, and he appears never to have used it steadily. His early experience with it, however, seems interesting. To W.D. Howells, in Boston. Hartford, Apple. 491. Dear Howells, I'm ashamed. It happened in this way. I was proposing to acknowledge the receipt of the play and the little book per phonograph, so that you could see that the instrument is good enough for mere letter writing. Then I meant to add the fact that you can't write literature with it, because it hasn't any ideas, and it hasn't any gift for elaboration, or smartness of talk, or vigor of action, or felicity of expression, but is just matter of fact, compressive, unornamental, and as grave and unsmiling as the devil. I filled 4 dozen cylinders in 2 sittings, then found I could have said about as much with the pen, and said it a deal better. Then I resigned. I believe it could teach one to dictate literature to a phonographer, and sometime I will experiment in that line. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.